Okay, I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Children, Families, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome to all. We will start, as usual, by having the clerk take the roll. Mr. Rohr.
Chair Pinto.
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler.
She's running a little late, but I know it's coming.
Lead Daniels. Representative Burkle. Representative Coulter.
Present.
Representative Davis.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
I think running a little late as well.
Representative Hemmingsen-Jaeger.
Present.
Representative Hicks.
Present.
Representative Hudson.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Perez Vega.
Present.
Representative Zalesnikar.
I think Representative Cadiz Witun is excused, I believe. And so we do have a quorum. And so glad to be with everybody. We're going to move approval of the minutes as usual. Maybe we'll continue just having there's somebody who wants to move approval of our minutes from the March 14th meeting. Do I have a motion? Okay, Representative Hicks, thank you. So members, minutes are from March 14th. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? All in favor of approval of the March 14th minutes, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The motion passes. Thanks all. And so Representative Perez Vega, maybe you can make your way up front because you got the first bill. And members, we're going to be coming back this evening, as folks will know from the agenda. I will say that the seventh bill on the agenda, we're going to sort of see if we're able to fit it in this morning, need to move it to the evening. We'll kind of see how things go this morning. Let's see if any questions anybody has about our agenda. Otherwise, Representative Perez Vega, House File 4176 was previously before the committee, and I believe that your motion is to re-refer it to the General Register. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, President Perez Vega. And actually, I guess the motion is, it was previously amended with the A24-0216 amendment, just to remind everybody. And you have another amendment as well, which is the A2. And can you just remind us what that is about, Representative Perez Vega?
A2 is striking districts and inserting district. You know, taking in from the old language, we're really trying to separate the two Minneapolis district and St. Paul public school districts, separate regions.
Thank you so much. And members, the A2, I believe, is Representative Perez Vega's bill that we had heard a couple weeks ago regarding splitting a VPK region that currently contains Minneapolis-St. Paul, dividing it into a Minneapolis district, a St. Paul district. We had a full discussion of that issue at the time. So Representative Perez Vega is moving the A2 amendment. Any discussion to that amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the A2 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. That motion passes. And then Representative Perez Vega, I believe, I don't know if there's anything further that you want to say. We already had testimony on 4176. This was the governor's early learning policy bill, and now we've just added on your Minneapolis-St. Paul bill. So maybe I'll just see if there are any member discussion or question anybody has about the bill, and then I'll give you the chance for any final words. So we're just sending this on, members. We kind of held on to it in case there are any additional early learning policy provisions. We had just the one. Seeing none, so Representative Perez Vega, final comments on your bill.
Pre-K is different than kindergarten. That's all I got to say about H4176 this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Perez Vega. So Representative Perez Vega renews her motion that House File 4176, as amended, be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so congratulations. Thank you, Representative Perez Vega. So we have gotten through one of our bills, and we've sent 4176 on. So Representative Hansen is not here quite yet. And so then we have Representative Nash, if he is here. Otherwise, we may be pausing a little bit. Or maybe we will, in fact, take that seventh bill and move it on up and have me. We'll see. We're going to give just a second in case Representative Hansen comes flying in for her bill, or Representative Nash for that matter.
Did anybody bring snacks
is the question from the vice chair.
I don't see any snacks.
Nobody, we do not see any snacks at the table.
It was worth a shot.
That's definitely worth a shot.
Care about
yeah. Well, one moment.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually don't have 4537 in the packet, so what I'm going to do is have staff distribute that. I'm not sure if Mr. Rohr will need the help or on the page. We'll get that out to folks. So again, we're just waiting a minute here for one of these contingencies to kick in. All right. Well, I think I am going to head up then, and we'll at least get started on 4537. So, in a moment, everybody. Everything's over by Strickler.
Chair Pinto, do you want to call down the testifier to join you now, or are you going to do an overview?
I think we have Ms. Didion join, sure, if that's okay. Madam Chair, yeah.
Sure. So, Chair Pinto, do you want to make a motion to move House File 4537 before us?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I will. I believe that the motion is going to be for it to be referred to the Judiciary Committee, and so I'll make that motion now. And then happy to explain the bill and the amendment as well.
Sounds good. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you so much. So members, House Bill 4537 is an agency bill from the Department of Human Services and the Office of Inspector General relating to children's issues. I'll have Ms. Didion, the testifier from DHS, explain the contents of the bill. And I'll just note there's an A3 amendment that both the first section of which has a provision relating to the use of water bottles that we'd heard about from constituents expressing concern about allowing families. Right now, child care centers are required to have the precise details regarding water bottles that you all will see in the A3 amendment. This would allow the family to bring the water bottle or cup home and wash it, as opposed to having the process that's described here. It seems like that's a good flexibility that's necessary. And then the rest of the amendment pulls some language in from a different OIG bill that is carried by Representative Fisher, Chair Fisher, but that relates to child care. And we want to make sure to pull that over. And so maybe I can move the A3 amendment at this time, Madam Chair, just to get that at least pulled in.
Sounds good. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The ayes have it. A3 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I think I'd like to have Ms. Didion from DHS walk us through the bill then, if I may.
Sounds good. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Ari Didion. I'm the Acting Legislative Director for the DHS Office of Inspector General. This bill is an agency policy bill. It's the Office of Inspector General bill relating to children's issues. I'd like to say thank you to Chair Pinto for authoring our bill. This bill contains five agency policy proposals related to child care, family child foster care, and private adoption agencies. So sections 1, 3, 5, and 23 relate to a proposal to move family child foster care to a continuous license process. So currently, these providers, after they initially apply, are expected to reapply on a periodic basis. What this proposal would do is shift that to a continuous license process where providers simply update their information on an annual basis, rather than having to reapply every 2 years. And this aligns with some shifts that licensing has made for other areas like child care. Sections 2, 6, and 24 relate to private agencies that oversee adoption placements. And this makes two changes. It replaces a requirement for these agencies to have an annual certified financial audit with the less burdensome requirement for an annual financial review. And this was based on provider feedback that certified financial audits can be very expensive to obtain. So this keeps the ability to do a financial review of these organizations in place without them having to get a certified financial audit. It also replaces the requirement for these agencies to have a licensed social worker oversee the agency's casework and puts in statute the experience and requirements for these providers instead. This is based on feedback from agencies, particularly in greater Minnesota and in rural areas, around the difficulty of finding licensed social workers. So we're hoping that this can help out with workforce needs. Sections 4 and 7 are cleanup items related to previously passed changes for child care centers. And these are just conforming changes to areas of statute that were missed for changes that passed in 2020 and in 2023. Section 9 is related to a proposal that would ensure that individuals who report a tip of fraud, waste, or abuse in the CCAP program have their identity kept confidential after an investigation is complete. And this just ensures that folks can bring these tips forward in good faith, and also aligns with Medicaid investigatory practice. And then finally, sections 8 and 10 through 22 are a series of cleanup changes related to certified child care centers. And I could go through those individually if folks have more interest. But that is the gist of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Didion. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing none. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you. Chair Pinto, I just want to say thank you for adding the water bottle provision into this. This was actually brought to me by one of the daycare centers in my district, so just really appreciate hearing the voices of people doing the job and the flexibility to make sure it's included this year.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and I apologize that I was slipping, because that it was Representative Hemmingson-Yeager that we'd connected with on the water bottle provision, and glad to get that added. Thanks.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair Pinto, I'm wondering on the A3 amendment, it had some wording on doors and things like that. Is that just to conform with current fire code? Because I think there's been a little bit of discrepancy.
Chair Pinto?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, yes. That's my understanding is that those changes are made to conform to the current fire code. That's exactly right. Yes, Ms. Diddy is nodding as well.
All right, thank you.
Representative Nelson, that's it. Okay, anybody else? Representative Daniels, did you want the last word on this one? Okay. Chair Pinto, last words on your bill.
I'm glad to have gotten this fitted in this morning. Probably everybody else is too. Thank you, Chair.
Sounds good. So you renew your motion to refer House File 4537 as amended to the Committee on Judiciary and Finance and Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion passes, and House File 4537 as amended is re-referred.
Thank you, Chair members.
So people can get ready. We're going to move on to House File 4459 by Representative Hansen while she gets ready.
So Representative Hansen moves House File 4459 for, I need to remind myself where the bill is going. And it is going to the General Register. So recommending for placement on the General Register. So Representative Hansen, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. Before you is House File 4459. This is a DHS Children and Family Services Policy Bill. I'll do an overview of each section as quickly as possible and then turn it over to the department and to you members to ask questions as fast as possible. Article 1 touches on our CCAP provider policy and making technical changes, including modernizing some of our mail requirements for providers, since they will soon be receiving notices or be able to receive notices through the online portal. And this will save mail from being sent to all over 3,000 providers, since assuming most people don't always need all the information sent to them in the mail, and a lot of them will elect that online option. This will hopefully save some postal money there. It also requires that providers be notified of their right to appeal and on their payment amounts and how to do that. It also applies the effective date to the one-star parent aware rating for all providers to be 7/1/26, since that was not included last year and should have been for proper implementation. Article 2 is the child welfare statutes, and first, this grants an exception to the moratorium for child foster care resident settings. Existing exceptions do not apply to child welfare statutes at this time, and that means that new programs seeking to become Family First certified for FFPSA are subject to the moratorium, and so this exemption will allow new facilities with specialized settings that are seeking certification. Sections 2 through 21 go on for quite a bit, but I'm just going to read to you this information from the summary document and just kind of breeze through a lot of these. So if you want to follow along there, it might make it go a little bit quicker. But we're removing some incorrect references to adoption and kinship assistance, benefit agreement expiration dates, since they don't actually expire. Clarifying the extended foster care payment procedures for youth in supervised independent living settings, including vendor payment options for youth at risk of financial exploitation. Aligning statute with existing department policy, allowing kinship assistance benefits to be transferred to court-appointed guardians when a named successor is not available or is not willing to become the permanent guardian upon a relative custodian's death or incapacity. Addressing the background study requirements and commissioner's authority in making foster care, kinship, and adoptive placements to support child safety and well-being. Clarifying that children in foster care cannot be placed in a family foster home when there is a known permanent disqualification to child care foster licensing. Clarifying that any party to an existing adoption placement agreement can terminate it, including the commissioner, who may rescind an adoption placement agreement when warranted. For example, if it's determined that the case did not comply with ICWA or MIFPA during the case. Amending various sections of Chapter 260C to clarify protective supervision case plans and court review requirements. Clarifying and separating petition requirements and court processes for transfers for permanent legal and physical custody to a relative and to a parent. And then lastly, removing the termination of parental rights condition that is based solely on a parent's failure to financially support their child. This article also amends two of the pieces of 260C, which further supports relative adoptions when children cannot be reunified with their parents. First, it allows the use of a child foster care home study associated with an active child foster care license to meet the adoption home study requirements. Even if the commissioner issued a sanction or conditional license within the last 3 years, if the commissioner determines it's in the child's best interest upon review of the agency's adoption placement decisions. And lastly, in the child welfare section of Article 2, it prohibits adoptions of children in foster care from finalizing when there's an active appeal and a contested adoptive placement under 260C 607 in subdivision 6. That was a lot to go through the child welfare statutes, also very heavy information, so I just want to recognize that the calendar does kind of require us to fly through this, but all of those things have really significant implications as well. Economic assistance in Article 3 is where we start there. First, it aligns the statute for how we classify rental income for people receiving MFIP. Next, it addresses the family violence waiver by removing the word imminent, because it does not matter if the safety concern is imminent. It matters that there's a safety concern. The waiver is designed to prioritize safety of all kinds, and this will allow it to do that. And lastly, the SNAP pieces in Article 3 address some of the barriers that are there in delivering expedited SNAP services. And in Sections 3 and 6, removing some old statutes that are out of date or not in compliance with federal SNAP requirements. And then lastly, Article 4 pertains to adoption records, and this aligns our adoption records with our latest privacy laws. And with that, I will turn it over to the department and members and chair for any questions.
Thank you so much, Representative Hansen. Thoroughly done. Thank you. There is an A2 amendment, and maybe we'll bring this one up now. And this is something that I had initiated in connection with the agency. Representative Hansen, I hope you're okay moving the A2 amendment.
Sure, Chair, of course.
Thank
Why
you,
not?
Thank you so much. And maybe Ms. Sommerfeld could explain the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This amendment addresses a quirk in the law that we've run into recently. If there's a report of threatened sexual abuse, the agency that's responsible for the investigation is to obtain information from the Predatory Offender Registry. But that statute refers to assessments, not investigations. And if there is, in fact, a report of sexual abuse or threatened sexual abuse, you must do a family investigation. So while this wasn't noticed for quite some time, and the BCA was providing records to counties recently, it was determined that providing information for an investigation, not an assessment, should not be allowed. So counties have been unable to obtain that information. This simply corrects that and ensures that when there is an investigation, we can get the information that's needed for child protection cases.
Seems like a pretty important fix.
Correct.
Additions, any questions or discussion regarding the A2 amendment, members? And hearing none, all in favor of approval of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The motion passes. And so any member of the public who wish to testify on this bill? And seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion or questions. Anybody has? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I just have a question regarding Article 4 and the balance of rights between adopted persons and birth parents. Am I understanding correctly that we're opening up the capacity of adopted children to access their birth records for the purpose of, for example, knowing critical medical information, while at the same time respecting the ability of birth parents to maintain their privacy if they so desire in terms of like contact? Is that what contact preference means?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. I'm going to have Jennifer Sommerfeld go into a little bit more detail about this. I think the goal here is to make sure that we're making adoption records available to all people who need them for their own life. I don't know the reasons, and I don't know that the government should be deciding those reasons, but also to make sure that the latest privacy laws are reflected, and then I'll let I almost called her Representative Sommerfeld, everybody. I gave her a demotion, I think that would be. I'll turn it to Jennifer to answer that rest.
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hudson, last year changes were enacted to allow adult adoptees to access their adoption records, not their adoption records, I'm sorry, their original birth records. So all this does is it aligns the statute that we have so that we as an agency can implement the bill that was passed last year. We're not making any changes as far as access to those records. We're just ensuring that we can implement it. There were some pieces missing in the law.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I guess what I'm looking for is there the ability, let's say I'm a birth parent, and I don't want to be contacted by my adult child that I adopted decades ago. Is there provision in law to ensure that that doesn't happen, despite the fact that they have access to their birth records?
And maybe that's a question about sort of current law that we passed last year, but in any case, it's helpful to know. And if somebody able to, Ms. Sommerfeld?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have all of the details of the bill that was passed last year in my head right now, but I believe there is a way, I just don't know how it works, for there to be some notification of parents, but the goal last year was to ensure that adult adoptees could get access to their birth records. There is a person here who was an expert on that bill who maybe can answer questions about that if needed, but I'm happy to talk about that offline.
Representative
Hansen.
Thank you. I'll just point out that in Section 2, there is a piece about birth parent contact preference form. And so you'll notice that my bill makes no changes to that piece, the beginning piece there. The last piece is that, we see in lines 39.4 and 39.5. Those are the only changes that are happening there. So there's more information in statute about how a parent can consent or not. And so I would point you to those lines.
And if we do have expertise that could give a short answer to the question just so we can get it answered, that would be good. Representative Hudson, do you Representative Whiteside.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your willingness to indulge the inquiry, but I was just curious if there was like a top of mind answer. I was interested in knowing what it is. I appreciate the fact that we're trying to maintain that balance. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. And my understanding is this is kind of an MDH issue, which may be a challenge for us answering it. Maybe what we can do is if there is somebody who has an answer, they can send it in, get it into us and get out to the committee. I'm certainly interested to know as well. Other questions or discussion regarding the bill anybody may have? Sure. Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for your work on this. It's an area that I really care about. The one thing I just want to highlight is more the appreciation of taking MIFBA into consideration when placing children. That's it. I just wanted to say that. Thank you to the agency for also making sure that we're really intertwining that in language and updates. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Members, anything else anybody has? Not seeing any. Representative Hansen, final word for you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. And I was also grateful, Vice Chair Keeler, to see this information here. Being able to stop that adoption when we find that there was changes happening or that something wasn't followed, I think is a best practice. And I think we should all recognize that we don't have to implement best practices into state law, but when we do, it makes everybody's lives better, including the kids who are most affected. So with that, I will ask you to support my bill. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Representative Hansen. So Representative Hansen renews her motion that House File 4459, as amended, be placed on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Thank you. The motion passes, and the bill is on its way. And thank you to Representative Hansen. Representative Nash is on his way up front. I will ask Vice Chair Keeler if she's willing to move House File 4793 be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
So moved.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Is the public? Actually, pardon me. I gave you the wrong motion. My fault. I think it needs to be moving to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. My apologies. I'm assuming you're okay changing your own motion.
So moved.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. My apologies for the wrong direction there. Representative Nash, welcome to the Children and Families Committee. We're so glad to have you, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thanks for having me in.
Please.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill before you, 4793, would change some principal things that are contained in the mandatory reporter law that we have, something that I have worked on with your side of the aisle and with the chair. For those of you who have not, I would recommend reading the Strib article called In Harm's Way. In that article, there was an articulation of effectively a diversion of a mandatory reporting event or events. And as somebody who has worked on the mandatory reporter language, when we entrust somebody to become a mandatory reporter, which is voluntary, we expect that they and the organization that they work for will handle that appropriately and from my seat immediately and not try to tamp it down or prevaricate it in such a way that it goes away. That's what was contained in the article. The bill itself has two principal areas of change on lines 2.1 through 2.4 and then 2.29 through 2.30. The addition of the stipulations that are in 2.1 through 2.4 effectively say that you may not have a policy, written or otherwise, that prevent or discourage mandatory or voluntary reporter from reporting suspected or alleged maltreatment of a child in accordance with this section. Let's boil that down. It says that if you are an organization that has mandatory reporters, that you may not cover it up and make it go away. It's just that simple. For those of you that heard me on the floor, I think it was two Thursdays ago, you heard a little bit about my story. And my story is one of growing up as an abused child. And I have two areas that I want to focus on as to why is this important and why are we dealing with this here in the state of Minnesota today. I had a number of mandatory reporters fail me. And one report was made by my favorite teacher. She recognized that as a kid, I had bruises, contusions, and that I had literally been abused beyond description. She brought that to the principal of the school that I was at, who covered it up and made it go away. The second instance of a mandatory reporter completely and utterly failing me was my mom. So my mom was the director of nursing. at the hospital that I was routinely taken to after my dad would beat the hell out of me. And my mom covered it up and made it go away. Years later, not too many years ago, I asked my mom, who was a mandatory reporter, I said, "Mom, you were a mandatory reporter in your job, weren't you?" She says, "Oh, yes, Jimmy." And she calls me Jimmy, but you may not. She goes, "Oh, Jimmy, yes, I did, and I saved so many women and children and people from horrible relationships and horrible abuse." And I thought to myself, well, the next question that I want to ask, I can never unask if I ask it. So I asked her, I said, "Mom, why didn't you save me?" And she didn't say anything for a while. We were in a car driving, and I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting to hear what her answer was. And she says, "Well, I guess I just figured you could take it." It's about the worst answer you could ever get from your mom, who is tasked with saving you from whatever. I mean, I've talked to my wife about this a number of times, and I think of my own responsibility as a dad. I would literally put myself between my kids and harm. And my mom did nothing and made it go away. So this bill is a way to take my experience and prevent it from happening again here in Minnesota, as we have seen in this article. And we have all heard of a number of these same types of instances. Once again, a mandatory reporter is a voluntary thing that you choose to do. And this bill, and it's not going to fix everything, it's a step of many steps that we have to take. And Mr. Chair, I appreciate you working with me, coming to my office and giving me this jacket, because this is something that I think we can all support. And for those members that haven't been here for a long time, we all have bills that we believe in because that's ideologically where we are, or we all have bills that we believe in and work on because it's good for our community. But then we have a number of bills that are very personal. That's this. So I would hope that we can get behind this. Because as you heard when I talked on the floor, let's prevent this from happening to the next Jim Nash or the next child that we don't know their name, because no child deserves what happened to the children in this article, and certainly what happened to me. We can do better, and we should.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Nash. And thanks for your work.
I'd be happy to stand for questions, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Nash. Let's see. First, is there any member of the public who wishes to testify on the bill? I will note, while I'm thinking of it and looking around, that's the case. This bill was presented to the Legislative Task Force on Child Protection in, I believe it was early February as well, and not seeing any members of the public coming to the floor. Members
Mr.
of the
Chair, there is a letter of support from the Minnesota Alliance of YMCAs.
And thank you for pointing that out, Representative Nash. Yeah, members, take a look at that, and support from the YMCAs as well. So we're going to move to member discussion or questions. Members. Representative Daniels, I think we can have you go last. We'll see if anybody else. So why don't we go to Representative Hicks? We can end with Representative Daniels before we go to Representative Nash. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this bill forward. A lot of times, young teachers, young new professionals, who are mandated reporters don't know when their boss says, "You have to tell me first." And this closes that loophole. So I'm just really grateful for that. I know everybody wants to do the right thing, and sometimes you just don't know what that is. And this makes it really clear what that is.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then moving to Representative Daniels then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this bill forward. I heard your story 10 years ago, and I don't know how you got through it, but you came out a better man after getting a whooping, broken bones, baseball bat, and you've been through a lot, but you're not that kid anymore. Now you have a chance to protect other kids, and I really appreciate that. You're a good man.
Thank you, Lee Daniels. And Representative Nash, thank you so much for making sure that other kids get the intervention that you deserved and did not get at the time. And it's and when you and I had the conversation about your interest in continuing your activism and your advocacy in this space, and we were talking about different ideas, and I have to say it did not click to me even when we were talking about this bill, as I've sort of realized how incredibly tightly connected, right, with your own experience this is, and just really so powerful. And so thank you for your advocacy on behalf of others. That's going to make a difference in kids' lives. So I'll give you the final word on your own bill, Representative Nash.
Well, I'll try. We all come here to do good work, and I think that we can rally around this. I can't talk to my mom about this, and to be frank, I don't ever want to see my dad alive again. Have no need to talk to him. That's a big statement. That's a lot to say. But the abuse that I got as a result of being in that house was bad, but it was compounded by the fact that I found out later all that I found out. To have your mom tell you that she just figured you could take it, I don't understand that. don't know that I ever will. But I am so grateful to the people who tried. So that teacher, I keep in touch with her today. And I couldn't be more grateful for her trying to save me. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Members, Representative Keeler renews her motion that House File 4793 be referred to the Public Safety Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Representative Nash, the motion passes. Your bill is on the way, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Good. Representative Freiberg, you are on your way up. Sir, and members, House File 367 is the next bill up. I'm going to ask Vice Chair Keeler to move House File 367 for placement, recommendation for placement on the General Register.
So moved.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler and Representative Freiberg. Welcome to the Children and Families Committee. Glad to have you here. I don't believe there's any. Actually, of course, every time I say that, I'm always wrong. There is, in fact, an amendment. And so the DE1-1 amendment. You'd like that moved, Representative Freiberg?
Yes, please.
Okay, Vice Chair Keeler, we move that to the DE1 amendment.
So moved.
Thank you. Okay, members, Representative Freiberg, well, tell you what, why don't we do this, if it's okay, members, is that we'll simply adopt the DE1, put the bill in the form the author wishes, and then they can present the bill, we'll have testimony, et cetera. So, and hearing, seeing no discussion or anything, all in favor of approval of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So the bill is amended. So now we've got House File 367 as amended before us. Representative Freiberg, please present your bill.
Thank you. That's a difficult act to follow, but I will try my best. So this bill would allow licensed child care providers to make individual choices to manage risk in the best interests of their businesses and customers, which are very young children and their families. Currently, licensed child care facilities and public schools are combined in statute governing immunization law. Several exemptions to vaccine requirements are allowed, including medical exemptions, exemptions for demonstrated immunity, and personal beliefs. House File 367 seeks to allow a specific group of independent businesses, licensed child care providers, the choice to make policy around immunizations only involving that last exemption, personal beliefs. This means that other exemptions would continue to be honored. The big difference between child care and public school settings is that child care facilities have a much higher concentration of very young children for much longer duration, who are at higher risk of death or serious health outcomes from certain vaccine-preventable diseases, such as measles and whooping cough. And infants are too young to get certain vaccines, whether or not their parents plan to when they become age eligible. They are all unprotected. This bill would simply allow each child care provider to make their own decision about accepting exemptions to vaccines only in the case of parental preference. Child care providers are private businesses and should be allowed to choose the clients they serve, within the bounds of anti-discrimination laws, of course, and vaccine status is not a protected class. This is not a mandate that all children must be vaccinated to enroll in childcare. This is not about COVID-19. This issue predates the pandemic, and the bill links to the standard childhood immunization schedule in law, which does not include COVID-19 vaccines for children. This bill is about individual provider choice in their businesses. It is about protecting the health of our most vulnerable. And it is incredibly and continually relevant. Just a few weeks ago, the Department of Health sent a warning letter to childcare providers across the state letting them know of a current outbreak in Dakota County and to be on high alert for spread. This alert is included in the committee packets. There are childcare providers on both sides of this issue, those that would continue accepting parental objections to vaccines and those that would consider adopting policies to not to enroll children that are unvaccinated due to parental preference. This bill simply creates the choice for providers about how they want to manage risk in their programs. And with that, I will turn it over to the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So, Ms. Sanford, we'll start with you, if you can identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Claire Sanford, and I am with the Minnesota Child Care Association. And I echo Representative Freiberg that Representative Nash is a hard act to follow. I have also been that teacher who was a mandated reporter and experienced a failure of the child welfare system, and I did not know his story until today, so I really appreciate what he did today. The fact that both childcare and public schools are treated under the same under immunization statute has been a significant concern to the Minnesota Child Care Association, or MCCA, for many years. That they exist in the same statute may have made sense at one point, but today several diseases once thought gone or nearly gone have reemerged due to dips in overall vaccine protection in the population, and the existing language no longer suits the current situation. Child care programs are very different in important ways as related to this bill, as Rep. Freiberg said, in terms of the age of children served and the concentration of very young children, and also the duration, often in care 50 plus hours a week. And given the severity of certain vaccine preventable diseases for these very young and unprotected children, we support giving child care settings additional flexibility when it comes to one exemption, the personal belief exemption. Measles, for example, has always been the scariest threat for child care. And this is a disease that was in fact declared eliminated by the Centers for Disease Control in the year 2000, but has reemerged continuously as community vaccination rates have dipped in the intervening years. It is very much not eliminated. And measles in a child care program is a nightmare that no one wants. According to Mayo Clinic, up to 90% of all those with no immunity will contract measles if in close contact with it. And you don't need to be with an infected person to get it. The World Health Organization notes that the virus remains contagious in the air and on surfaces for up to 2 hours after an infected person has been there. It can also be transmitted days before the telltale rash appears and anyone realizes that this might be something more serious than a cold. If exposure occurs, all unvaccinated children, which is likely at least all the infants in a child care program, need to quarantine for 21 days. That's 3 weeks of fear for those families waiting to see if their children get sick, 3 weeks of no child care and potential time away from work for those families, and 3 weeks of loss of income for providers who often cannot last that long without that revenue. Providers are simply asking that they, as individual businesses, have the ability to set customer policy to better manage the severe health risk in their programs. It affects their customers, staff, and livelihoods. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And so then we figure maybe both of the testifiers make their way on up, Dawn Uribe and Sheldon Berkowitz, just to sort of keep ourselves on time. I think there should be a third chair up there, yeah. And Dawn Uribe, if you can please identify yourself and proceed. Then, yeah, Dr. Berkowitz, perfect, yeah. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dawn Uribe, and I'm the owner of Mis Amigos Spanish Immersion. We have four centers in the metro area and serve about 300 families. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning in support of HF 367. I agree that parents should be able to choose whether or not they immunize their children. When my oldest son was a baby, I read all the things about vaccines and it scared me. Because I had the option to stay at home, I made the choice to delay some of his shots until he was a little bit older. I opened my first preschool when my kids were 3 and 5. They were fully vaccinated by then, but I sympathize with parents who made the decision to not immunize. The change in my policy came when I started enrolling infants in our schools. The mission of my business at the most basic level is to love and protect children. I believe that one important way I can protect babies is by requiring all other children who attend my schools to be vaccinated. Infant parents who don't have a choice to immunize or not, their only choice is to attend a school where vaccines are required of others. I have a duty to protect children who are enrolled with me. There are two reasons why I think child care centers should be allowed to set their own immunization policy. One, we're different from public schools due to the age of the children that we serve. A good part of our children are not able to have the measles vaccination, and they are at the greatest risk. Two, we are a private business, and we have the right to set the philosophy and the policies of our school. Parents choose my school because they believe in our philosophy and our policies. I am not asking people who oppose this bill to change their minds, and I don't want to impose my personal beliefs on them. By the same token, I should have that same right to make decisions for myself and for my business.
Thank you so much. And then Dr. Berkowitz, moving to you.
Chair Pinto and members, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Dr. Sheldon Berkowitz, and I'm a retired pediatrician, having worked for over 20 years at Children's Minnesota Hospital. As others already said, hearing Representative Nash's comments was so painful to hear. I'm also the immediate past president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, an organization representing over 1,000 pediatricians around our state. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 367. This legislation will lead to increased rates of vaccination among all children, making our communities, schools, and our kids safer and healthier. During my lifetime and medical career, I've been fortunate to see vaccinations develop that have made diseases such as polio, many forms of bacterial meningitis, and measles almost unheard of in the United States. I've also seen what happens when vaccination rates in the community decrease, putting children and adults at serious risk, as we saw during the 2017 measles outbreak. It is well understood in the medical community that for most vaccine-preventable diseases, if at least 95% of the population is vaccinated against that disease, the chances of unvaccinated individuals spreading a disease are very low. However, if vaccination rates drop below 95%, we are all at risk of getting sick. Unfortunately, starting before the COVID pandemic, but continuing to this day, we are starting to see childhood vaccination rates decline well below that 95% mark. In some cases, parents are refusing vaccinations based on religious beliefs or things they have heard from friends or read in the news or on social media, or simply believe that their child doesn't need the vaccination. Whatever the reason is, declining recommended vaccinations not only puts their own child at risk, but also other children around them. In 2023, the CDC noted that nationally, only 93% of children entering kindergarten were fully vaccinated. In Minnesota, according to MDH data for the 2022-23 school year, vaccination rates were even worse. Just under 90% of all children entering public school kindergarten were fully vaccinated. Most childhood vaccinations occur between 2 months of age and 2 years of age. By passing this bill, our chance of getting all children fully vaccinated and our community vaccination rates back up to 95% or higher will improve. I urge you to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Berkowitz. So we're going to move on to public testifiers, and I'll ask Tony Morimoto to make your way up. And then if the next testifier, Patty Carroll, can just sort of be ready to go, maybe be sitting near the front, that'd be great. So looking for Tony Morimoto. Well, maybe, not sure, maybe. And otherwise, if not, then Patty Carroll can make her way on up. So we'll find out. And then I know you, yeah, sorry. Yeah, and I think you had something you wanted distributed, and I'd taken a look at it, and it's fine to get it. We'll get a copy of members. And if you can please identify yourself and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Patty Carroll.
Okay.
I shortened up my testimony because I was told I could only have 2 minutes, so I won't go through a lengthy introduction, but I began studying vaccine policy over 23 years ago after my son suffered permanent brain damage from vaccines. I did not receive true informed consent because I was not warned that vaccines can cause debilitating injuries or death. And sadly, misinformation on vaccines is even worse now than it was two decades ago. But an interesting thing happened when the government openly lied about the safety and efficacy of the COVID shots. People saw the coercion and manipulation in real time. They heard the media narrative change on a daily basis. They watched friends and family die or be injured by the COVID shots, and then they began to question the entire vaccine schedule. Advocates were forced to sue the federal government to reveal the truth, but we now know that vaccines are not required to prove that they even prevent infection, much less transmission of disease. People now know that vaccine makers have zero incentive to make safe products since they bear no liability for harm. People now know that the CDC's schedule has never been tested for safety. And yet, here we have a bill that would essentially legalize the discrimination of children simply because their parents have chosen to exercise their religious freedom and avoid putting toxic products into their children's bodies. Promoters of this bill say that private businesses should be free to discriminate if they want to, but many daycare providers in Minnesota are not truly private or independent businesses. They take taxpayer money through state and federal grants. So this bill could force us, the taxpayers, to fund companies that would then be allowed to turn around and discriminate against us. That is not acceptable. They claim that legalizing discrimination would somehow protect other kids, which is not true, based on the FDA's own licensing standards. So I ask you to follow the facts and not the propaganda and protect our children and save your vote no on House File 367. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm so sorry for what your son experienced. Appreciate you being here. Thank you. Jerry Johnson is up next, and that'll be Chuck Finley after that. And so once you get settled in, if you could just identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Imagine that you are a young parent. You must work to support your family, and therefore you must have reliable child care. And imagine that if you wish to deviate even a little bit from the standard immunization schedule and this bill passes, your child care providers may refuse to accept your child. Imagine that maybe you plan to give many of the vaccines to your child, but let's say not the hepatitis B vaccine. You understand that hepatitis B is mainly transmitted during sexual activity or sharing needles, and so you choose not to give this vaccine now. But then if this bill passes, you may not be able to find child care. Child care is hard to find already. Or imagine that you choose not to give your child the chickenpox vaccine. But if you skip just that one vaccine, child care providers can then shut you out. Or imagine that you simply want to space out your child's vaccines. Rather than giving your baby six vaccines at a time, every 2 months, you want to separate them and slow it down. A lot of parents are choosing this now. But if your child care agency insists that you adhere to the CDC timetable, and they will have you hand in your vaccination records, that may be too intense for your child. Or imagine that your child has already experienced a vaccine injury. Maybe she was healthy and sitting up on time, and then right after her six-month vaccines, she lost the ability to sit up. As a parent, you would be in a desperate dilemma. You would have to either risk repeating that vaccine and harming your child further, or being unable to go to work because you can't find childcare. I'm a former public health nurse, and I'm a co-founder of National Health Freedom Action, an organization that stands for the right of all individuals to make their own healthcare choices. As adults, many of us here work in public places with exposure to many people, yet we all choose our own paths for health and healing. For adults, there are many vaccines recommended by the CDC. Yet, each of us weighs the risks and benefits of each vaccine and then chooses. Maybe none, maybe some of them, maybe all of them. We have that right. This right to choose must also be maintained for parents who are responsible for their beloved children's health and well-being. Vaccination is a medical intervention that is irreversible. If a child is injured by a vaccine, they cannot be unvaccinated. Minnesota has always stood for the right of parents to make healthcare decisions for their children, and this bill would remove that option for many parents because they would be unable to find childcare that's accessible to them.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being with us. And then Chuck Finley is the last testifier. And so once you, Go back to the table if you may, please. Sure. Thank you so much. No, I'm back. And then I'm going to ask the page to come up to you, and I'll just need to see a copy. Or that's the presentation we had. Yes, I'm going to have Mr. Rourke. We have their pages distribute rather than testifiers themselves. Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, just sit back at the table. Yeah, we'll do that. And while we do that, I'll actually note that the first testifier, Patty Carroll, again, had something that was distributed to all the committee members. And so we'll have this distributed as well. And then please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Chuck Finley, Libertarian Party of Minnesota. I also emailed this to everybody, if you want to look at that. There are two types of polio vaccines, IPV and OPV. We've only distributed IPV since the year 2000 in the United States. According to CDC, IPV does not prevent transmission or infection. It's on their website. And that's a very good reason. It's because you get IgG antibodies, antibodies in the blood, not IgA antibodies, which is transmissible from fecal to oral, which is how polio is transmitted. Did anybody know? Raise your hand. Polio is not transmitted. Yeah, polio vaccines cannot be transmitted. Anybody? No? The Tdap vaccine, pertussis, super interesting study by the CDC. Vaccinated people shed just as much pertussis as unvaccinated people, but they don't have symptoms. Who's more likely to spread pertussis, asymptomatic people or symptomatic people? Asymptomatic people, right? We don't ban vaccinated people from childcare. That'd be ridiculous. Then, of course, there's a huge study by all the world pertussis experts, and what did they find? They found the pertussis vaccine does not prevent herd immunity and does not prevent colonization and cannot prevent transmission or infection. Who knew, raise your hand, that the Tdap vaccine cannot prevent transmission or infection? Did anybody?
This isn't so much an interactive thing,
well,
I'm afraid.
Nobody knows this. I mean, this guy, this doctor over here is saying, oh, 95% of vaccines. That's not true. It cannot prevent transmission or infection. The CDC says so. The WHO says so. Kathleen Edwards, maybe the number two person expert on pertussis vaccine, says so. Now let's go to chickenpox. Just chickenpox is exciting. Did you know that you're able to transmit the chickenpox 6 weeks after vaccination? It's in the packet inserts from the manufacturer, but we don't quarantine children for 6 weeks after they get the chickenpox vaccine. That's ridiculous. So what's this really about? It's a proxy way to ban black people from childcare because they're the most resistant against vaccination since the Tuskegee trials. If you don't know what that is, you should Google it. It's very scary. And it'd be just like in the 1980s, same argument. We should ban gay people from childcare to prevent AIDS. It's just as ridiculous. That does not prevent transmission or infection. There's absolutely no public health reason to do this. It's ridiculous. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being here. And then any other, and I don't know how much time we're going to have for this, but is there somebody else who does wish to testify, a member of the public? And maybe I'll ask, we've got two, yeah. So I can have each come up. We're going to need to keep it real short, though, just a minute or so, since we had not signed up in advance. I'm happy to do this, but then I do want to make sure we move to member questions and discussion. So if you can please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Yeah.
My name's Diane Smith. I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother recently, and a teacher and an advocate for children. I've got vaccine inserts right here. I'm here to testify against this bill. The vaccine inserts, look how thick they are. This is of three different vaccines. If you want informed consent of anything being injected into your body or your children's body, you should have informed consent. I never had informed consent for my own kids. I vaccinated my babes. And then they entered into the hospital. Every year they got vaccinated. And I did not put two and two together. So I did all the rules. I followed all the orders. I wanted to do the right thing. And I thought I was doing the right thing so well that it took me 3 years. Please get off your phones if you're on your phones, please. If I'm taking the time to come up here and testify, I really, really am asking you for your full attention.
And I should say we've got just about maybe 30 more seconds, I'm afraid.
The book that is in front of you shows Patty Carroll's son is in here, and a lot of other kids are in this book. I encourage you to read it, because what you are basically asking is, I don't know if the vaccine's going to injure you, but hey, go get it anyway in order to come into this building. Show me your papers. They did that in Nazi Germany and said, show me your papers. You don't get to enter. Okay. You're repeating history.
Thank you for being with us. And then the final gentleman there, yeah. So thank you, sir. And then you'll be our last testifier. If you can please identify yourself. And then proceed.
My name is Steve Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am a consumer of healthcare. People react differently to the same therapy. We've all been asked if we've been allergic to certain drugs. When I donate blood, the iodine swab on my arm causes a rash. What is innocuous for most people causes a reaction in me. The same is true with vaccines. Not everyone will react the same to the shots. The majority of children will only suffer mild reactions, but some children will suffer severe reactions like high fevers, constant crying, and even seizures. When a parent witnesses a severe reaction, it is dangerous to require another dose of the vaccine. Minnesotans have high rates of vaccinations. Over 90% of children have received their shots. Yet some parents have valid reasons for not following the recommended vaccine schedule. I think that we have heard some of those already today. Let's be candid. All pharmaceuticals have side effects for some people, including vaccines. For this reason, we should allow parents to be able to weigh the risk of vaccinating their child and obtain an exemption if they desire without threatening the loss of access to daycare.
Thank you.
Trust parents to make an informed decision regarding the health of their child. Please vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. And so we had the amendment already, and so I think we're ready to move to member discussion and questions. So Representative Lesnikar, starting with you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I guess, you know, it brings me back to the 8 surgeries I had when I had my breast cancer. And before I went into surgery, I signed that up to including death could happen because I had no choice. I had no choice. I was twice in a life and death situation, and I made that choice. I see this issue when I look up every single one of these vaccines. If something says to me as a parent that serious injury, not just allergic reaction to the iodine, serious injury is possible, up to including death. If that's on there, I say this having vaccinated my kids, and when I was vaccinated, the number of vaccinations are quite different from 66 when I was born. But when I've looked at this, if that says that on there, as a parent, we just heard Nash's bill where we're protecting children. As a parent, if you read those things, you have an obligation to be thinking through how that affects your child, what you're willing to live with. Because at the end of the day, I'm giving permission for something that includes that. And I have to weigh the risks and the benefit, not the government, not me here, but I have to. Because the pharmaceutical companies are protected.
something happens to your child and it's disabled for the rest of its life, or you die, or your spouse dies, or somebody else, up to death, nobody's coming to help you. Not the government, not the pharmaceutical company. There's provisions of protection. So if that's the case, you're protecting that. Who's protecting the victims? That's what I'm saying. These are real people here. These are real people. This is not some conspiracy. There have been people that have had vaccine injury. So I say to people, look, there are many people that are going to look at these things and evaluate it. Not only that, people want to put things in their body that they believe are natural. We have more and more people that are going to co-op foods. They're looking at what they're putting in their body for food. Last year we passed a cannabis bill. There's many people that want to do that because it grows from the ground, it's natural. And yet now we're saying to families, by the way, you don't have a choice for a poison that could kill you. It's a medication and a vaccine. And both of them, we all make those choices. But to not give families that opportunity to make a decision is going to be one more step that's going to affect the workforce. We have 50% child cares we've lost. Greater Minnesota, I can tell you, there's a big propensity of people in Greater Minnesota that are not all following all these guidelines for their children. So if there are not providers for them, we already have 50% loss in child care. Who's going to take care of the infants, the babies, and the children so that people can go to work? Are we going to have further exhaust the system of not having child care? Because these families are going to exit the workforce, and then they're going to take remote jobs, which is not health care, assisted livings, nursing homes, hospitals. They're not jobs you can work remote. People that leave those fields, somebody's got to fill it. And where are we going to get more workers? And who's going to take care of the children? If they can't have a provider and have these opportunities, then they're just going to make a decision to exit the workforce at a time when we are trying to get people back in. My other point is we're accepting the medical exemption. So in theory, the child could be at the center or the family place that has the ability to infect somebody, just the same as an exemption, conscientious exemption. But we're just going to remove one group of people. We're not going to change the risk factor for any of these children at the child care center because we already have some we're going to allow to be there for a medical exemption. So this is just further going to complicate the issues. I feel like families have to have the right to choose. They know the medical history. They know their family medical history. And if something's on a CDC that says it's a possibility and it's on there, I looked up every one of these vaccines to see if anything changed. And if that's on there, people have a right to choose. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg, I didn't hear a question, and I'm inclined to keep moving and then give you a chance to kind of respond more broadly to things a little bit later if that's okay.
That's fine.
Okay, good. So Representative Hicks is up next.
Thank you so much. So I've heard a lot today about, you know, medical exemptions and people have, if they have a reaction. And so I have one of those kids, like y'all met her. She's the cute little one that sleeps in the back with the curly puffy hair. So Ellie has chilled in pediatric ICU, I don't know, a dozen times. She has a rare autoimmune condition called mast cell activation. She was not able to get vaccinated on a schedule because she did have a reaction. Like room fills with people with EpiPens and lots of medication, scary, gross reaction. Absolutely happened. You know what happens when that happens? They give you this form and they sign it and they say that she had an allergic reaction and that you can have a conversation about a different vaccine schedule and you can make choices because she did have a reaction. That is true. But she also had a reaction because she cries sometimes and her mast cells do weird things. But if Ellie can't be vaccinated because she has a reaction that is true. My daughter's throat has closed. She has stopped breathing from a variety of things many, many, many times. I've been in the scary room in the ER at Mayo with the glass cubicles lots of times. It's a real thing. Yeah, it is very scary. That is not the same thing as I don't wanna. It's just not. It's not the same thing. And as a parent of a child who has real, very dangerous, very, very scary medical conditions, I am insulted that that is somehow equivalated similarly. It's not. It's not the same. This bill protects kids like my daughter, who could not be vaccinated, who had to have an alternative schedule, who had to go to kindergarten without vaccines, who when COVID hit, could not return even when everybody else did. And I'm very tired of being looped into a group that is somehow the same. Rep. Freiberg's bill does not say that my daughter can't still get a medical exemption for the things that she is genuinely allergic to. That's not what it does. So let's just clear that up. Thank you, Rep. Freiberg, for protecting kids like my daughter. Thank you. I appreciate you very much in this space.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for sharing your heartfelt, passionate personal story. My task here is to try to reframe and restate some of the points that have already been made in a way that I hope will be received with less exasperation. I detect a lot of exasperation in the room with a lot of the objections to this bill. I regret that because I feel as though the points that folks are trying to make are legitimate points that I trust you can see some merit in. And I'll start with the testimony from Dr. Berkowitz. It was a very interesting statement that the doctor made. He said, "This legislation will lead to increased rates of vaccination." It's a very interesting statement. By what means? How are rates of vaccination going to be increased as a result of this bill? Coercion. Denial of public accommodation. Forcing you. We've had conversations in this room, around this table, about the immense value of childcare, not just to the parent and the student, but to society at large. We've talked about it at length. And what we're saying with this bill is that it's really super duper important for people to have access to childcare. And we're going to deny them that really super duper important service as a means of coercing them into putting a substance into their child's body against their medical judgment. Representative Hicks, your experience with your daughter is one that I cannot imagine. I too have been in the hospital with my son, not knowing what the outcome would be. I understand the passion that drives you to characterize conscientious objection as merely not wanting to. But that's not what it is. No choice made about the medical treatment that one receives or that they consent to on behalf of their child is made flippantly, without concern for the health of themselves or their children. I mean, that's the concern. That's what we're being presented with here by our testifiers, is concern over risk, the assumption of risk. And there are many ways in which we assume risk. We assume risk every time we get out of bed in the morning. Every time we get in a car, we assume risk. Some risks, we have a choice whether or not to assume. And other risks are assumed merely by existing in a society. I don't get to impose myself upon other people in order to evade risk. And that was the root dispute over the past few years as we went through the pandemic, is does my fear entitle me to impose myself upon my neighbor? And the answer we heard loud and clear from state government was absolutely. Absolutely, you can impose yourself on his business. You can impose yourself on his family. You can end his career. You can shut down his church. And now we're saying you can keep his kid out of child care based upon the medical decisions that he or she makes. There was another point that was made rather flamboyantly by, I want to get the name right, Mr. Finley. Yes, thank you. I appreciate that, Representative Freiberg. Regarding discrimination, unintentional, I believe, I sincerely believe, unintentional discriminatory impacts of this. By saying that, because we know for a fact that there are certain populations that are more skeptical of vaccines than others. The Somali community comes to mind. The Black community comes to mind. And they have reason. The Tuskegee experiments. Damn right. Rational cause to doubt state authority. Not for the first or last time. And so what we're doing with this is we are unintentionally, I am assured, creating a mechanism to go backwards in terms of segregation and public accommodation. Because you're saying that if you are part of one of these populations that is more likely to be skeptical of vaccines, we're going to keep you out of spaces. It could actually affect the upward mobility and the decision to move from one community to another, because surely, you know, you might make the argument that in Somali communities, for instance, the child care centers in those areas will not opt to have a policy that excludes children who have not been vaccinated according to the schedule. Fair enough. But they'll have those policies in Edina. They'll have those policies in the inner ring suburbs. They'll have those policies elsewhere where people are afraid. And so that impacts the ability and the decision of a Somali family to decide to move to one of those communities. And so you're furthering all of the disparities and inequities that we are constantly seeing presented in these discussions. I can tell I'm not winning anybody over with this, and that's fine. But I hope that at the very least, there is some degree of respect for the fact that people are entitled to control their own bodies. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Representative Lee, you're up next.
Thank you, Chair. Rep. Hudson, you won me over a little bit, so do you want to clarify that? Because, you know, as always, I want to reorient us back to the bill, and I think you have great points that I think actually tee up my remarks really well. First, to reorient us back to the bill, I wanted to point out to members that in the amendment that we adopted on line 2.12, again, you know, we use the word may, not shall, right? And so we are not forcing any sort of vaccine mandate. That being settled and clarified, I do want to offer one of my own stories, right? All of us interact with healthcare every day, and it's a very personal experience. I recently had a really bad reaction to antibiotics, which were supposed to help me. But I had the privilege and the opportunity to go back to my doctor and say, hey, this didn't work. I need help addressing this reaction, and I need to know what other antibiotics I can take so that this doesn't happen again. So I do want to say, like, I want to note there was one doctor who testified, and you know, a bunch of other folks who had an experience, a really adverse experience with their health care that they received. What I think is disappointing, and what I want to know if these people were able then to follow up and had the opportunity to follow up with their providers to explore other options, or, you know,
remediate what happened. Because I also do want to acknowledge that women are actually more likely to die after taking similar doses that are prescribed to men because their bodies absorb medication. And, you know, when we look at, you know, medical studies, this is why we have to have diverse test groups, right? Because people react differently. And so I do want to acknowledge that. But, you know, I also want to say, because you have your, you know, data point and your adverse reaction, that does not also give you the license to, you know, extrapolate and also spread false information that may harm other people. I also want to acknowledge for the people watching this live stream, there were a lot of false equivalencies and a lot of comments made that were really insulting and disparaging to many communities. Appreciate Rep. Hudson pointing out the discriminatory comments that were made earlier against Black Americans. I, as a daughter of refugees, also understand the hesitancy of vaccines. In refugee camps, people are also required to take immunizations before they immigrate to the United States or other Western countries. And, you know, people also feel a lot of fear interacting with Western medicine. So I want to acknowledge that as well. That is true. But what is really important is for parents and their children to have a trusting relationship with providers to be able to make informed medical choices. And I also want to acknowledge not everyone has that opportunity. So when we talk about our Somali American community members, what we should be doing is making sure that they have trusting relationships with providers so they can make informed decisions. But I'm going to just close here because I do want to say, you know, I appreciate folks sharing their stories. But what's important is that this bill provides an option for providers to also create safe childcare facilities for the kids who do need this protection. And I thank Rep. Freiberg for bringing this bill before us.
Thank you, Representative Lee. We've got a couple more folks in limited time that have not heard from the bill author in a long time. So I'm going to ask folks to keep it real short if you can. Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Thank you, Chair. I just kind of want to lift up what Representative Lee said. And, you know, there is some hesitancy with people with getting vaccines, but I also know there are groups out there that are targeting communities to give them misinformation, to encourage them not to get vaccinated, which I think is equally as scary. When we think about this from a public health perspective, this is one way that we can help with this. Representative Lee talked about trusting relationships. I cannot think of someone who is more trusting than child care providers, and to have the opportunity to have a conversation with your child care provider and say, why are you making this business policy decision to change? They can have that conversation. The child care provider can say why it's important to protect our littlest ones, and they can have a conversation from there and get accurate, real information. I'll share my story too. My daughter was 3 when we had a big measles outbreak in Ramsey County. She was being taken care of by a child care provider in Ramsey County. She had one set of the measles vaccine, but I was like, ooh, what do we do? We had an appointment. We got the information, and we actually vaccinated her early to protect her because we knew we could be out in the community where measles is airborne, and we had that opportunity to have those conversations and protect her. So I just kind of want to make sure that we're all out there. And I will say in the scientific community, we have spent billions of dollars refuting something that was known by a journal article author to be false. So if you'd like to talk offline about that, we can do that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Representative Coulter. If I can ask you to keep it real quick, because we have one more member after you, and I really want to give Representative Freiberg some time. Representative Coulter.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for signing up late. I honestly went back and forth about whether or not I wanted to speak to this. But I just want to, first of all, acknowledge, I know many of us in this room are parents. Many of us in this room are parents of young children. I am a parent of young children, and I want to acknowledge that parenting is maybe the most personal journey I have been on in my life. And so I do want to state that I really respect how personally every individual parent takes that journey. We've heard a lot of talk about how this bill affects the choices that people are able to make. And I think it just needs to be stated how the lack of this current language being in current law affects the choices that people are able to make. And when we talk about vaccinations, we are not just talking about individual parents making individual choices for their kids. We are talking about individual parents making choices for other people's kids too. And the reality is that I want to be able to make the choice for my kids, knowing that they are safe from preventable diseases when I send them to a place. That's what this bill allows. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Davis.
I will be short, Mr. Chair. I won't go into the story, but I too have a child who has had serious adverse reactions to vaccinations. I'll just point out a few points here. What I heard was a testifier saying parents unable to work because he can't find child care, and I understand that it's a may, not a shall. But from the pile of letters in support of this, facilities receiving taxpayer dollars from those parents, it's obvious the decision they're going to make. And what if all of them make that decision? Then we certainly are discriminating. And that's what I thought we were trying to prevent. I apologize to everyone in this room who is afraid for their child to get a vaccination, and you were told that it was just personal preference or just because you want to, after you put in the hard work of doing research and you were fearful for your child to get a vaccination. I apologize to you for some of the comments made during this committee hearing, because I know you love and care about your child very much. Heard another testifier say we need to trust parents to make an informed decision for their children. And that the heart of what America is and what Minnesota should be, absolutely. We do need to trust parents to make informed decisions for their children. Land of the free, home of the brave. I have one question for the author of this bill. How many reps have signed on to your bill that you dropped last year in January?
And this is will go to Representative Freiberg. And Representative Davis, after you get that question, will you be done or want to come back? You'll be all done. Okay, so then Representative Freiberg, you can respond to the question and then provide your final comments. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. This bill, I see where you're going with this, Representative Davis. I honestly don't spend a lot of my time trying to get bill authors to sign on. I just wanted this bill introduced so we could begin the discussion as quickly as possible. I know there are very many members who support it. I know there's a Senate companion with authors. I've introduced similar bills in previous sessions that have authors, but to the extent there's no other co-authors on this one, that's on me. But I know there are plenty of members who support this and support vaccinations in general.
And Representative Freiberg, thank you for your final comments on your bill.
Okay, thank you. This is a public health bill. Representative Coulter, you covered that very well, how this affects not just this affects two different groups of parents. I mean, everyone wants their kids to be safe. But vaccines, I just want to bring us back to one key issue here. Vaccines are safe. They're listed as one of the great public health
achievements. Just ask the public, please. Yeah, no sound from the public. We need to focus on our testifier.
Vaccination is listed as one of the great public health achievements of the 20th century. And we also need to consider the risk of diseases like measles and whooping cough, which are potentially deadly. I don't remember measles outbreaks when I was a kid. I believe there's a correlation between declining vaccination rates and these outbreaks. If there is a health impact to a child, the medical exemption is still in place. I direct your attention to line 1.11 of the Delete All Amendment. In relation to this bill, the comparisons to segregation and Nazi Germany are offensive. First, as Representative Lee said, this is just a choice. It's not shutting off access to all child care. There are providers who will make this choice and others who won't. Second, if a provider serves a specific population, they may choose not to change policies because they decide the financial risk to their business of not serving those customers outweighs the health risks of not accepting personal belief exemptions. Third, 3% of all kids aged 2 to 5 enrolled in child care have this exemption. 3% doesn't sound like shutting out entire communities. Fourth, child care providers can use this as an opportunity to educate their customers about the health benefits of vaccines, and many already do that. There is a lot of misinformation out there regarding vaccines. We've heard some today. I'm glad Representative Hemmingson-Yeager mentioned the targeting of misinformation to vulnerable populations. Providers often offer families state and county materials on vaccine education. Of course, in the end, everyone should be directed to their healthcare providers, and I'm glad this is supported by medical providers such as Dr. Berkowitz and that we've heard from them. This is an important public health bill. It's become more difficult to talk about in recent years. I think that's unfortunate, but I encourage members to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. I'm going to take chair's prerogative and just say something before we vote. I want to direct members' attention to the letter, especially from the Minnesota Medical Association, the 10,000, more than 10,000 medical professionals in our state that have endorsed the bill. And in addition to the public health benefits, I just want to point out that this bill, as I see it, would increase the freedom of business owners to decide to adopt a policy they wish. I understand they receive taxpayer dollars, and I will say, if you want to use that principle of businesses accepting taxpayer dollars so we can regulate all sorts of things, I'd love, let's continue that, and a lot of other sectors as well. It also increases the freedom of parents who have immunocompromised children, who have infants, to be able to choose a provider who they could find that would actually require vaccines. Right now, that is not an option for those parents. So this would increase the freedom of those parents without taking away the freedom of others, right? This is something that would increase their freedom. And for that reason and for others, members, I think that it's something that should pass. And I'm now going to go to a vote, and so I'll ask for all members. It was Representative Keeler who had who's renewing her motion, House File 367, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The motion passes. Representative Freiberg, your bill is on its way to the general register. Thank you for your work. Thank you, Ms. Sanford. Thank you to all the testifiers on this bill. We will reconvene at 6:30 p.m. in room 10. I expect it to be relatively short, members and members of the public as well. And so we'll reconnect then. So with that, the committee does stand in recess. Okay, calling back to order this meeting in the House Children, Families, Finance, and Policy Committee. I'll note that I think this evening's hearing will be quite short, and I appreciate members. We have a very people on the on our video cannot see. We have a very tiny audience, but we're grateful to those who are here. You are a terrific audience, though. Members, we had quite an intense hearing this morning between the presentation by Representative Nash, the final bill by Representative Freiberg, and just a lot going on. I appreciate members hanging in there, and just want to make sure. That we continue to do the work of democracy together, recognizing how challenging that can be. And maybe I'll leave that at that for now. But I want to then make our way through and have Representative Hansen head up, if she can, for her bill. One moment. So Representative Hansen moves House File 4898 for referral to the General Register.
Thank you, Chair.
Yep, and so that is your motion. I do not see any amendments, and so please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. I am back with round two of FAME, as promised, to continue to expand this program to help more people. House File 4898 is a bill to expand on the FAME support that you all showed me last year. As a reminder, FAME is the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota program, which is a match savings program with financial coaching for working people living under low incomes. The funds can be used to build assets in education, housing, vehicles, emergencies, and economic development purposes. This bill clarifies the definition of household so that people living under the same roof but not sharing the same financial arrangements would not be considered one financial unit. As an example, roommates in an apartment, which most youth these days, my daughter's 19 years old, and most every one of her friends, they do not live independently because of the cost of rent. But the roommates in an apartment could disqualify each other from participating because of their combined income, even though it's very clear that their dollars are not combined. It also amends the income eligibility guidelines so that the agency can use either 50% or less of an area median income or less than 200% of the federal poverty line, whichever is greater, to determine income eligibility. The income eligibility is set at 200% or less of the federal poverty line, which is generally fine, but in the case of single wage earners, many are just over that income eligibility. This population would be an ideal group to receive the FAME to support their journey to economic self-sufficiency, but that federal income guideline just barely excludes them. So this will allow FAME to reach more people and do more of the good work that you all supported me in last year. And then I will turn this over to the chair and the members for questions. I don't know if my testifiers are here.
Testifier does not appear to be here. Do we know if they're? So in our large audience, Is there any member of the public who wish to testify? There's several sergeant arms that perhaps will not be, and I don't know if there's anybody else who wishes. I do not see anyone. Representative Hansen, are we aware of your testifier not about to burst in the door?
I mean, I have not heard from them, but I think that we can have a conversation about this, and should they show up in a moment. Otherwise, I am happy to collect a written testimony and share that with the committee after the fact and potentially have it posted as well, if that would be okay.
Fair enough. Okay. So we are then ready for any member discussion or questions. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I appreciate you providing an example of what the intent of your language is, because, to give you a little peek into our thought process, we were looking at this language and kind of asking ourselves, what is she trying to do? Like, is this? It just seemed undeterminative in terms of what the exclusion for consideration of household income was. So, would it be fair to say that your intention is not to exclude, say, a spouse or like a working teenager or somebody along those lines?
Representative Hansen, pardon.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I'll try to go through the chair.
No, I appreciate that. Sorry,
late
little
evening here. Yes, is the answer. Right. We just want to make sure that the folks that FAME is aimed at helping are people who don't have a lot of assets. I was a teen mom. I had my daughter at 17 years old. I would have been a prime person to work with FAME and really would have benefited from it. My family taught me how to avoid bill collectors, not build credit. And so this is something that would have helped me. But I would have probably gone a little bit over on this because I had a roommate at one point in time, though our money was never combined. It was just to keep a roof over me and our children's heads. So.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, as I look back on my dwelling with roommate years, I'm sure some of them could have arguably been contributing more than others. But I appreciate what you're trying to do here. Would you entertain the possibility offline of looking at language that further specified that that's what you're aiming at, as opposed to potentially opening it up to immediate family members?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. Of course, we're always looking at making sure we can expand FAME to as many folks as possible. This has received bipartisan support. Match savings programs are a great way to help people build assets, and so the further we go, the better. I just made a commitment to you all last year that I would bring more forward and continue to expand this to make it available to more folks.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Zalesnikar. Oh, she's good. Okay. Thank you. Hey, no problem. Other questions or discussions, members? Okay, not seeing any. So, Representative Hansen, you get final words on your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, not just for today's hearing, but for your ongoing support of FAME and making sure that we can help more folks achieve financial independence. Thank you.
Okay, with that, Representative Hansen renews her motion that House File 4898 be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The motion passes, and the bill is on its way. So I'm going to make my way up to the testifier table.
I think we're going to start with House File 4732. Chair Pinto, as you get settled, let me know when you're ready. Next on the agenda is our early learning vehicle bill. Chair Pinto, please proceed with your bill. You have a motion that House File 4732 be re-referred to the General Registry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, members. So just to pause and orient everybody, these final bills on the agenda, and I'll note that there was originally another bill on this agenda, which is part of the reason we were thinking that we were going to be filling up this time this evening, and then that bill ended up being pulled by the member in question. House File 4732 is, as the chair said, an early learning vehicle bill. What that means is that this is a bill that would be available if we're able to reach an agreement with the other body to have a conference committee relating to early learning, specifically that this could potentially assist with that process. I will say candidly, members, and happy to talk with you all offline as well, that continues to be a challenge, figuring out how to line up the pieces of this committee with the pieces over there in the Senate. And so this provides some flexibility opportunity for that. And so I would ask members' support to have that set up for the vehicle bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I don't have any testifiers listed. Is there anybody in the audience or members of the public that would like to testify on this vehicle bill? Seeing none. Discussion to the bill. Okay, seeing none. Chair Pinto renews his motion that House File 4732 be re-referred to the General Registry. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Ayes have it. House File 4732 is re-referred to the General Registry. In your same packet, in the same green folder, you should have House File 5033. That's the one we'll be moving on to next. So we have another vehicle bill. Chair Pinto moves that House File 5033 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Chair Pinto, please take a minute to tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, so then this is another vehicle bill, and the purpose of this, members, is that as we have some provisions, and I'm thinking especially of the work that's coming out of the Legislative Task Force on Child Protection. There's some pieces, some bills that have been introduced, and I'm expecting us to be hearing relating to fatality reviews, so reviews where there's been a death of a child or a near death, relating to reform of the system. There's some components that may relate to data practices and judiciary issues. And so in order to be able to accommodate deadlines and sort of make things work, the plan is to send a 5033 to judiciary, and then to the extent that we would need to then put on there any provisions that relate to data practices would need to be heard in the Judiciary Committee, we have a bill available for that purpose. And kind of allowing, since we're now at the deadline and won't be able to move bills forward without having to send them to rules, this is a way to do that. So I'd ask for members' support just for that flexibility to confirm any substantive provisions, of course, would be coming through our committee anyway, but this allows for the judiciary components. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, don't see any testifiers for this. Giving a minute for any public testimony. Seeing none, discussion on the bill. Seeing none, Chair Pinto renews his motion that House File 5033 is re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion passes. House File 5033 is re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Moving to the last bill, 4980. In front of us, 4980. Chair Pinto has one final bill to present. This is the Human Services Forecast Bill, House File 4980. Chair Pinto moves that House File 4980 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Chair Pinto, please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So members, we had a couple weeks ago a early learning forecast bill. It was the actually, I think we had the whole bill in front of us, all of education finance, but we discussed the portion relating to early learning. It got sent to Ways and Means. And so this is the equivalent of that for the DHS portion of our committee's jurisdiction. I don't feel like we did a very good job of explaining what that bill was at the time in this committee because I was sort of stumbling over it. But fortunately, we have Mr. Berg here, who, Madam Chair, if you're willing, he could explain to us better than I can about what this bill is about.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, yes, as Chairman Pinto explained, this is the forecast article which lines the forecast that was just came out last month up. It makes that happen. So when you saw the headlines about this is how much money we have and what has happened to the budget, this adjusts all the appropriations from human services that are forecasted from what they was appropriated last year. There have been two forecasts. This catches the state budget up to the changes that occurred in those two forecasts. And specific to this committee are lines 2.5 through 2.9 and 2.13. are the forecasted programs that are within this committee's jurisdiction, which is MFIP, MFIP Child Care, and the North Star Care for Children, which is adoption and foster care and kinship assistance.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. And maybe Mr. Burke could confirm, I believe that this bill is a clone of a bill carried by Chair Liebling, and so those other lines are in the jurisdiction of Chair Liebling, and so then these bills kind of, each of them gets heard in the proper committee, and then Ways and Means, one bill advances, probably the Liebling bill.
Madam Chair, that's correct. this bill is going to go, both bills are going to go to Ways and Means, and Ways and Means is going to move one of them to the floor.
Chair Pinto?
Nothing further to add. Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone present wishing to testify? Seeing none, discussion on the bill. Wow, I'm so good at this, right? We're really like moving this right along. Okay, seeing no further discussion, Chair Pinto renews his motion on House File 4980 to be re-referred to Committee of Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion passes. House File 4980 is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Chair Pinto, do you have anything else you would like to say?
I just want to say thank you to members for their patience and their work today and this week, and we will see everybody on Thursday morning. Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.